Hello and welcome to the Intrafish Podcast, where we bring you the most compelling and interesting news in the seafood sector. I'm Editor-in-Chief Drew Cherry, joined by Executive Editor John Fiorillo. It's been a crazy run of travel. It is show season again, and that means a lot of handshakes, a lot of seeing folks we haven't seen in a long time. A lot of quiet corner conversations about what's happening in the industry. So we have been doing a lot of news gathering and have a pretty good view of what's on the industry's mind right now. John, why don't we kick off with Boston? I think both you and I and several other people in the industry felt like the show was back. Felt like the show was return to its old form, it's for me anyway. It seemed like a great show and news and meetings and a lot to be learned. What was your take?
Yeah, I think that's pretty accurate. I mean, just the attendance was like the old days, and the exhibit hall was literally full from one end of the hall to the other, and that hasn't been that way in a little bit. It just felt normal, which since the last 3 years have felt anything but that. It just felt like a normal Boston. All the restaurants were packed at night, and so it was nice to see, and people, you didn't see many masks, and people seemed more relaxed and, kind of their old selves. So, from that perspective, it was really a nice event.
Now, I think that the big events that sort of set the tone, everybody wanted to hold their M&A news to time it with the show, so people have figured out that that's a great time to catch people's attention. And in quick succession, we had a few really, really big ones. You broke the Fortune International acquisition. Fortune International, it's a seafood supplier and now gourmet food supplier as well, that's just gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. And they made probably their biggest acquisition to date, $285 million company, Boston Sword and Tuna, giving them access to a whole suite of additional products that Boston Sword and Tuna have built up expertise in over the past several years. So what's it going to mean for Fortune, John?
Well, it gives them what they, they've been growing this pipeline of distributors and specialty companies. And what they need is they need to fill that pipeline with some real top quality seafood product. And this will give them that from the East Coast for sure. The Boston Sword and Tuna, it's a legit player, 300 million-ish, 34 million pounds a year. All the popular stuff: swordfish, salmon, tuna, scallops, lobster. So it seems like a very strategic buy for them. And then Boston Sword and Tuna is, I believe, a fifth generation family, so that kind of dovetails nicely into Sean O'Scanlan's kind of outlook on things. He likes these traditional family-run businesses tend to be on the smaller side from an acquisition point of view. But, since they announced their expansion plan in 2012, about a decade ago, this company has just been buying one smart buy after another and stacking them together. And they've built quite a little empire right now. And I imagine there might be another one in this general philosophy. And by that, I mean they might need more supply coming up as if they keep going. So, Sean didn't say anything about any future acquisition, but this one is really interesting from a supply point of view, which, as I said a minute ago, they clearly need some supply to keep up with all these businesses that they're buying.
Yeah, I mean, and it was one one acquisition after another, and the commonality is that they're all kind of consolidation of the U.S. And North American industry, which, I mean, the level of fragmentation continues to be so high. But as you can see with these family-owned companies, you're getting to a place where people, maybe that next generation isn't going to want to make that journey. And just there's just a lot out there on the market, it seems, right now to snap up. Day prior to that, John, you broke another story on Southwind Foods to another supplier, big in frozen items into major club stores and retailers. And Southwind acquired Cato Fisheries, and that's a California seafood processor. And kind of the same story, right? Is that they kind of were there, a family-owned company looking for an exit, and then Southwind's going to use that as a springboard to supply other markets.
Yeah, and in both these cases, you know, these companies have been working together for a while, so they know each other very well. They, their operations are synergistic in the sense that you're not going in somewhere and, you know, changing a culture or anything like that. These companies know each other. They work in similar fashion. So, I'm not saying it applies to either of these two transactions or any of the four that big ones that happened at the show, but I was trying to get some perspective from people at the show and I wasn't very successful. But my thought is, you know, we are at the post-COVID moment, let's say, knock on wood, you know, let's say it doesn't rear its ugly head in a new way. But and all so many companies survived COVID. A number thrived during COVID. So let's not forget that. And I'm talking seafood here. But a lot of them just survived. And they've come out of the other end exhausted, probably weaker. And I'm wondering if this little surge that we saw is, if there's something more behind it, in the sense that the stronger companies that came out of COVID, the ones that came out stronger, if now there's a lot more opportunity for them to bring in some of the ones that just have been exhausted during COVID and may not be as strong. And again, I'm not saying it's these transactions we're talking about, but in the broader picture, I wonder if we're going to see that unfold.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of these companies that limp their way through, especially ones that are supplying the food service sector, like I said, if they made it through, how well did they make it through is the question. And then I'm just going down the list because there were so many, but Peter Pan Seafood also made an acquisition, a smaller sort of bolt on. Remember, Peter Pan Seafood was acquired by Roger May, who's been in the seafood industry a long, long time, together with McKinley Capital and RRG Global Partners, two equity groups. And so, the Trappers Creek Smoking Company, I believe that gives them ins, John, into some of the club stores. Is that correct? Is Trappers Creek? It used to be in Costco. I don't know if it is anymore, but.
Yeah, it used to be in Costco. I don't think it is anymore, at least in the ones out here on kind of the Pacific Northwest. But, you know, this goes along with what Roger and the new owners said right from the get-go, that they want to expand Peter Pan into a value, you know, into more value-added product lines. Well, you know, you don't get much more value-added than smoked seafood. So, they're going in the direction they promised when they took over. So, they have a few brands under the company they just bought. So they will have retail presence in that sense. And it comes at a good time. You know, it's not best time to be in wild salmon as a commodity. So, we'll see where it goes.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about the big one. The big one was Cook striking again. Actually, in the middle of linked already with a big, huge deal that we were kind of tracking, and then all of a sudden, in comes the really big deal, which is Cook, the Canadian giant now that's got its tentacles everywhere across the world and in so many different species. Cook acquired Slade Gorton. And Slade Gorton is one of the oldest seafood companies in the U.S., still operating seafood companies in the U.S., family-owned. It is one of the most high-profile companies in North America, certainly in from an industry point of view. They have loads, hundreds of product lines, in a lot of different retail areas and food service as well. I mean, it's just a huge, huge a deal for Cook. So, John, what does this mean now? That Cook is now even deeper into distribution. It gives them great opportunity for all their pipeline of products, obviously into the market. I mean, we can barely keep up with Cook.
Yeah, I mean, how do you? They're growing at a rate unseen in this industry in my time. I've never seen a company continue to grow, and they're not little tiny growths; they're giant growth spurts. And this one is it makes a lot of sense to me. I could be wrong, but it makes a lot of sense because the bigger Cook gets and the more diverse its portfolio of products and regions they source from, this just gives them that pipeline into the more important end of the business, which is your customers, your retailers, your food service, your broadliners. And, you know, all those links are established firmly through Slade. I mean, Slade has, as you mentioned, been around for a long time, led by Kim Gorton, sharp, sharp CEO. I know a few years ago it was struggling. I don't know how it came out of COVID, but it seemed from the outside anyways that it had recovered well and was strong. Nevertheless, it is embedded into the buy side of the business in the retail and food service categories. And so they bought a great distributor is basically what they had, and they didn't really have that. So I don't know if Glenn is done yet or if this is part one of something else. So
I would assume that it's just the latest move. I mean, he's obviously Cook's now there are a number of acquisitions. We put together a list that will show you in a couple of stories there that kind of track just how they've grown. And over the last 5 to 10 years, it's just been a massive upward curve linked with Nueva Pescanova, the Spanish seafood giant now. So there's bound to be more. It's just, I guess the question is, what areas are they most interested in growing? And then we'll kind of see. But no doubt, we're going to see more from Glenn Cook this year. But this was a really big one. So let's move over to the Power 100, the Seafood Power 100. We haven't put one of these out, John, in I think about 3 years, and we figured it was time. There's been so much change. It's always fun to put these together. It's always challenging. There's always a lot of arguments that could be made about who we choose. How do we do it? Well, how do you measure power? It's something where you could argue back and forth a million different ways, and we have over the years about who's belonged on the list. But we did our best to be broad geographically. We focused on who was controlling the major sets of species or the major political decisions. We did not have we made the decision to not have financial companies on there. But anyway, it sparked a lot of discussion, debate. We've gotten feedback about our choices. John, what do you think? Is there any sort of through line this year that was different than when we did it a few years ago?
I mean, there was some turnover. I wouldn't say there was a lot of turnover. So, there's, I would maybe translate that to mean there's been some stability at these, powerful positions within the industry. No, overall, I think, if you were to say, well, how did they come up with this list? Well, if you go to major events around the world, related to seafood, there's a pretty darn good chance you're going to see overwhelming percentage of these people at these events. And that is, testament to their influence and their stature in the industry. So while it's always open to debate, like you said, I think we hit the right notes, for the most part. And yeah, these are the people who take a good look at them, because these are the people who are steering your industry. And if you don't know them, you probably should.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, I think, I was surprised there was quite a few changes. I thought, as we were putting together the list, some really big folks that dropped out that, boy, we're used to having on that list for a long, long time. So there were some changes there. Some more younger faces, I think. That's one thing that you can see, quote unquote, younger. A few more women, but not many. We obviously, when you are in the C-suite at a major company, it wasn't just C-suite that we had in the Power 100, but it was mostly C-suite. And people have argued and said, well, the real power behind the company is X, Y, and Z. And you know what? Typically, or maybe not typically, but a lot of times that's the case. A lot of times there's maybe the chairman's pulling the strings, or even the COO is maybe doing a little more of the heavy lifting. That's just how it is. However, when you have that CEO title, you are at the top. And so you ultimately have that power, whether or not you're allowed to exercise it, or if you do exercise it, I guess, is open for debate. But female CEOs, continue to be lacking in the seafood industry. I mean, it's just gonna be some time to make that changeover. Up at the top, Teresa Loch-Bouryard and Helena Zivdouki from Skretting and Cargill, respectively, sit really high up on the top. But it's down there. Still, the industry has a lot of work to do. To change that. You're seeing more regionally, you've seen some move on that to bring in younger people, female leaders. I'm thinking of Grieg and some of the other salmon companies. You're seeing them move some women into more management roles, which is good to see. But I think fair to say we've got a long way to go. I think one of the areas that we got criticism for that I'm going to cop to, and I think they're it's changing. Part of it is our own need to educate ourselves, and part of it is, I think, that engagement with the wider industry a bit more, and that's in Asian seafood companies. It's very, very difficult to zero in on who it is that holds power in China, for example. I think India, there was a couple names there that we really should have had on there. We'll remember it for next time. I think there's some good arguments to be made about how we might get a clearer picture of the power dynamics in Asia. So, we will work on that, and for the next time, we'll maybe have a little bit broader palette. And who knows? By the next time we do it, whenever that is, we'll probably have quite a few different faces as well.
Yeah, I think that was a fair assessment that we heard from, several people that matter. And yeah, I mean, there with these things, there always is a limit to some degree about how bulletproof you can be on everything. But yeah, we've done this. I can't remember how many we've done, but every year we learn a little more. If we're doing our jobs right, kind of keep perfecting it. And you'll never be perfect, but it can always be better.
Yeah, well, it was a lot of fun to put together. Everyone is more than welcome to give us feedback on it. We love to hear it when we're wrong, right? Otherwise, we heard a lot of people at Boston coming up to us, and it's all over LinkedIn and social. You can see people kind of commenting on one another, either congratulating each other or making, comments that somebody should have been on there. And that's great. It is subjective. It's part of what we're trying to do is generate discussion, debate, and actually make the industry a little bit better by getting everyone talking about these things. Okay, back to Boston just a minute. So we had our leadership breakfast there. We do our leadership events most of the shows. And we had a really interesting panel. In some ways, one of the more diverse panels we have in terms of sectors. And that made it a lot of fun because everybody kind of approached it from a different point of view. John and myself were moderating this event. Up on stage, we had Sydney Ajambuja. He is the Director of Strategic Sourcing at Red Lobster. We had Cora Campbell, the CEO of Silver Bay Seafoods. We had Travis Larkin, President and CEO of Seafood Exchange. We had Einar Gustafsson, the CEO of American Seafoods. Anna Vistendahl, the Global Head of Seafood at DNB. It's a really, really interesting panel. So, John, what were some of the themes that were hit on that stuck out to you?
Well, I'll let you elaborate on this one a little bit more because you were talking directly with Cora about it. But referring to what you just said a few minutes ago, maybe the lack of women in leadership roles in seafood, and you and Cora discussed that, and that was a really interesting section of the panel or portion of the panel. So that struck me. I think there were some comments about eco labels, both from the Red Lobster, from Sydney, from Red Lobster, and Cora again, that they kind of tell you about the frustration and growing, growing like anger, I think, towards all these labels and having to deal with them from a paperwork point of view and all these other things, and how the labels really are starting to seem very porous and weak in these times of climate change. I think it was Cora who said, "Hey, look, we do what the management tells us to do, which is stop fishing a resource, and then we get penalized for it by having the label yanked." She said, "But that's exactly how the management's supposed to work, right? If there's something wrong with the resource, management steps in and says, time out, we're not going to fish anymore." So she was really frustrated about that. And Sydney too had some pointed comments about labels. So that was really interesting. The other one that caught my ear was when Einar was asked about the U.S. pollock fleet versus this brand new fleet being built up in Russia, and his response was, "Bravo, to the Russians for building the fleet, because he would prefer to see really high-end quality product in the market, not only from the U.S., which has traditionally been producing high-end stuff, but from Russia, which has often just sent product to China for reprocessing and then had all this twice frozen stuff in the market that the Alaskans had to compete against and educate buyers about why one was different than the other. So he was very supportive of this and thought, it would lift the entire market ultimately if Russia ever finishes this modernization. I mean, they've done some boats, but their ambitions are to do quite a huge modernization. I can't remember how big, but so yeah, those things pop to mind immediately.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in general, the mood on the market was kind of interesting. I mean, people were pretty frank about, I think long term, obviously, it's hard to not believe in seafood's promise if you look at all the macro trends. But in the short term, you know, there was a lot of concern and a lot of expected changes going on. I know Travis Larkin with shrimp in particular, you know, it's a real frustration that the boom and bust cycle of shrimp just doesn't seem like it's going to end anytime soon. I think that it really undercuts the promise of that species. You know, it's still the most consumed species in several Western markets, or the second most. And it's on the up and up in production. But in terms of its of the boom and bust cycle of when prices get high, seeding too many shrimp, and then you get disease, and you get a bust on the volumes. I mean, that seems to be a trend that plagues the sector. The other thing too that I thought was very interesting, that was a theme that kind of hits multiple species, is cold storage. And I mean, every single person on that stage mentioned this, that there is the cold stores in the US and in Europe are getting full. Their species, I mean, shrimp's a great one. If these species don't move, they sit there in cold storage, and that's not, it's no small thing. That's a cost, because you have to pay for every minute that your product is sitting there in cold store. And it was the same with wild salmon. Cora Campbell mentioned that. It's a big challenge right now. So even if the logistics issues have been maybe straightened out a little bit, cold storage and moving products is still a huge, huge issue.
Yeah, and that's not going away anytime soon. So yeah, everybody mentioned that, and no matter which species, they seem to be struggling with that issue. So there's just not enough capacity for all the product that is needs to be stored, and this is still part of the supply chain disruption. And I mean, you can link it all the way back to COVID, I guess, but it's going to take time for all this to wrinkle or to iron out. And we'll see. The one thing you don't want to see is lower consumer demand. And I'll speak for the U.S. right now, although the same is going on in much of Europe. Lower consumer demand for seafood, because then you're not getting any pull through. You know, you're not getting it pulled through the retailers or even the food service outlets. So the stuff in cold storage has nowhere to go. So it would be really, really nice to see some of these retail sales figures that we report every month. It'd be really nice to see those start to move in a positive way. And we did just a little bit in February, but it looks like it's probably was tied to Valentine's Day and the Super Bowl, which are, you know, big seafood celebration times where volumes pick up anyway. But March will tell us a little bit more. But it would be really, really good news to people if we could see some pull through happening.
Yeah. Well, we will find out how things trend, and we'll look at the macro economy and see which way things are going, which it seems like a roller coaster. But we'll see as the year goes on. Reminder, if you haven't seen our Power 100 that we referenced in the podcast, you can go to intrafish.com. You'll find it there on the homepage. You can also sign up for our newsletters there. We've got plenty to choose from, including John Fiorillo's new Wave newsletter on retail and food service markets for subscribers. So with that, we'll wrap it up, and we'll look forward to speaking next time.